Black Africa in shambles. That was the headline, Black Africa in shambles. And it was a 6-page article, and it's one of the best summaries that I've ever seen on the situation in Africa. And I thought I'd begin my sermon by just reading a little bit of what it says here in this particular article. There is a quote from the president of Ghana, the first president of Ghana. Ghana's had so many that it's very difficult to keep count. But the first president of Ghana, after it received its independence from England, was Kwame Nkrumah. Ghana was the first country in Africa to receive its independence. The reason for that was Ghana was the richest country in Africa. It was the most viable economy in Africa. So Britain gave it independence first. That was in 1957, 26 years ago. And on Independence Day, Kwame Nkrumah gave a speech, and one thing he said was, "Our aim is to make this country a worthy place for all of its citizens, a country that will be a shining light throughout the whole continent of Africa, giving inspiration far beyond its frontiers." Newsweek then continues, "It was the beginning of the end of colonial rule. After nearly a century of exploiting the continent's wealth and its people, the European imperialists were pulling out, sometimes peacefully, sometimes at the point of a gun. In 1957, Ghana won independence from Britain, the first of 44 nations to gain their freedom over the next 20 years. But now, 25 years later, the glowing predictions of Nkrumah and of other black African leaders have not come to pass. The bright futures that they and their people envisaged amid the pomp of their exuberant flag-raising ceremonies have turned into gloomy and often gruesome tableau. For the most part, black Africa today is a collection of nations in shambles." And then it goes on to talk about all the wars going on in Africa, the coups, the man-made disasters, the drought, the disease, the famine, the tribal slaughters, the banditry and graft. All of those things, and it goes into details to a certain extent of them. But then further down, it talks about Ghana. Ghana, once the lodestar of African liberation, showing the way for other nations, is a case study of black Africa's troubles. When the charismatic Nkrumah first took power, his ambitious dreams of the New Jerusalem, the golden city of our heart's desire, as he called it, may have sounded a bit grandiose, but understandably so. On its Independence Day, Ghana boasted the highest percentage of educated black citizens in Africa and the most professional black civil service. Four major newspapers competed freely and fiercely. So did two political parties. Ghana had a corner on the lucrative world cocoa market, and its treasury bulged with £600 million on Independence Day. Yet Nkrumah squandered it all. As Nkrumah became increasingly autocratic, he mercilessly taxed cocoa producers and farmers to build a burgeoning bureaucracy. 97% of the adults in the church are civil servants. Gives you an idea of the bureaucracy. To build a burgeoning bureaucracy and finance a lavish personal lifestyle, Ghana's civil service, swollen by Nkrumah's sycophants, grew to fully 70% of the country's workforce. Now, most of our members live in the two big cities, Accra and Kumasi. And in the cities, I'm pretty sure it must be 90% of all the people are civil servants. But taking the country as a whole, including the farming areas, it would be 70%. Now, compare that to England. I don't know what it is in England. Maybe 15% civil servants, perhaps, out of all the people working, maybe even less. And people here complain. Spurred on by easy credit supplied by overseas contractors, garish prestige projects sprouted in the capital of Accra, swallowing hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues. Needless industrial schemes — they even have an atomic energy research center — needless industrial schemes, notably, it mentions that, a nuclear power plant in a country already exporting hydroelectric power, were launched. And Nkrumah piled up a personal fortune estimated at $7 million, $1960. By the time an angry army overthrew him in 1966, Ghana was over $1 billion in debt and well on the way toward chaos. So that was the first president, ruined the whole country, basically. And since then, it has gone from bankruptcy to bankruptcy to bankruptcy. Every government tries to find money just to get by each month. I spoke yesterday to Steve LeBlanc, who's down there still, and he was saying there's been no petrol or diesel oil available for a couple of weeks now because the country simply does not have the money to buy any fuel, so there's nothing coming in. No food is imported by the government. Just nothing comes in. There's been no spare parts in the country for a couple of years, so that it's very dangerous driving. You're driving behind a car and suddenly it breaks down and you almost hit the person. Or maybe while you're driving, somebody in the other lane will come right over to your side and almost crash into you because people's brakes don't work. People's tires blow out because they can't get new tires. People are using, I can't remember what it is now, caustic soda mixed with something else as brake fluid because there is no brake fluid. It's a country which is just totally bankrupt. And what a contrast that is to Africa's most successful economy 26 years ago under British rule. Now, my wife and I have had 9 years in Africa. First of all, we lived in Rhodesia, which was then ruled by Ian Smith, for 3.5 years, and then we've had just over 5 years in Ghana. So we've had almost a total of 9 years in Africa. And during that time, increasingly, we've learned a great deal about the people, and I thought today what I'd talk about is highlight the 7 major problems that hold Africa back and show the biblical solutions. The 7 major problems that hold the continent of Africa back. Now, I could make it 70, but I don't want to keep you here all week, so I've limited it to 7, and we'll try and get through those in an hour and a quarter. When we got on the plane just over 3 weeks ago in Accra, and then we got off the plane a few hours later in London, the contrast was just incredible. And while we were on the plane, we just started to feel so much more relaxed as we got further and further away from Ghana. Now, sometimes traveling so frequently between Accra and London, it has often struck me that these two cities are in the same world. They're both populated by human beings created by God. Why are they so different? London is not necessarily a very nice city, but at least there is a certain degree of order there, whereas in Ghana there is no order at all. In London, when you want to get on a plane, you just turn up at the airport, you check your suitcases in, hand over your ticket. You might have to stand in line for a few minutes. They take your suitcases and then you go right through to the departure lounge and you're on the plane. In Ghana, it's not like that at all. You can get a confirmed ticket, but when you get to the airport, it means absolutely nothing. You have to fight to get a seat because they always overbook. People in front of you will be handing money to the people behind the desk so that they can get on the plane instead of you. So you have to really push and shove to try and get a boarding card. And even when you get a boarding card and a seat allocated, it means absolutely nothing because somebody else could have had the same seat allocated. So it means nothing at all. So you, even when you're going out to the plane, you've got to run and push past other people to get on the plane. My wife and I got this down to almost an art, because I would run ahead carrying the bags and she would come behind with the kids. And when I got onto the plane, I would just sprawl myself across the seats while waiting for my wife to come, holding the seats against other people so that they were there ready for my wife and children. It became a lot more difficult when we had 3 children, so often I would leave my wife behind. It's difficult to sprawl yourself over 5 seats, but initially over 3 seats wasn't so bad. Now, why is all this chaos there and so much order in our society over here? Well, let's have a look at these 7 reasons. The first 3 are the biggest reasons, and I want to spend most of the time on them. But the major reason for Africa's chaos is its attitude towards the Israelites. In Genesis chapter 12, we see an interesting scripture. And this is an economic law of God that never fails anywhere in the world. It just never fails anywhere in the world. In all of the countries that I've been in, and people I've talked to have said the same thing, it is a law of God which does not fail. In Genesis chapter 12, we see this written. Now the Lord had said unto Abraham, get you out of your country, and from your kindred, and from your father's house, unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. Then in verse 3, I will bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you, and in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now I wonder if anybody has a Revised Standard Version here. Mine is still in Ghana. If I could just borrow it for a minute, I just want to read verse 3 in that, because it's a better translation of verse 3. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse, and by you all the families of the earth shall bless themselves. You see, God gave a blessing to Abraham's descendants because of Abraham's obedience, not because his descendants were going to be great. I mean, all you have to do is look around our society and realize that we are not perfect. So it is not because we are perfect that God gave the blessing to Abraham. It was because Abraham was the most faithful person who's ever lived. And because of Abraham's blessing, because he obeyed God unquestionably, God gave to his descendants a great physical blessing. The physical blessing of the British Empire, of the United States, and of all the wealth which they have. But God also opened up to other nations, through Abraham's descendants, the same physical blessing. Perhaps not to the great extent, but certainly a physical blessing. Now today we are taught repeatedly, everywhere, in every newspaper, even the conservative ones, take this as a fact. We are taught repeatedly that colonialism was a curse. And yet God says exactly the opposite. That the British Empire was a blessing. The French Empire was a blessing. Israelite nations ruling over Gentile peoples. He says, I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse, and by you all the families of the earth shall bless themselves. Or in the King James, in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. There was a blessing brought upon the world by the rule of the Israelites. Now again, that does not mean we were perfect, and don't misunderstand me, a lot of bad things were done. But on the whole, on balance, what was done was good and not bad. And I have the word of God to back that up. But here we see in the second part of verse 3, particularly in the Revised Standard Version, that God says, by you all the families of the earth shall bless themselves. Now all the non-Israelite nations can bring upon themselves a great physical blessing by their attitude to the Israelites. And this is an economic law that never fails wherever you go. The nations who are friendly towards the British and the Americans, who welcome their people into their countries, who welcome their investment, who have friendly relations with them, those nations are the one with the highest standards of living. The nations that curse the British and the Americans, that don't like their people in their countries, that want to kick them out, that don't allow foreign investment from those nations, they are the ones with the lowest standards of living. Ghana is surrounded by three countries that still have very good relations with France. They are all developing economically. They're all relatively prosperous, while Ghana is getting worse every month. Now, when I was in Rhodesia, I remember the government explaining that when they projected the country's economic development, they projected the number of jobs for Africans on the basis of how many Europeans there were in the country. Now, all whites in Africa are known as Europeans, even if they come from America or Canada. They're still called Europeans. And they would plan these economic projects on the basis of how many Europeans there were. For every one European, there were seven jobs for Africans. Now, that does not mean every European had seven servants. Far from it. Maybe a European couple, like my wife and myself, when we emigrated to Rhodesia, indirectly we provided jobs for 14 people. Now we only had one servant, so where were the other 13? Well, the goods and services that we demanded and the wealth that we created and the other Europeans created produced all of those jobs. Now that to me is an economic law again, which I have seen work all over Africa. Now Ghana would deny it because they would say, well, everybody in our country's got a job. But of course they don't have a job. They're all civil servants. No offense to anybody who's a civil servant. But the civil servants in Africa spend all their day sprawled across their desks doing absolutely nothing. There is nothing to do. So it's a job simply on paper. Real jobs come about from having Israelites in their midst who develop the economy. The Israelites have the technological know-how and the organizational abilities which enable an economy to be well run. They're the only ones who can get gold out of the ground. Ghana is the world's third biggest source of gold, or rather it was. The third biggest deposits of gold in the world are in Ghana, after the Soviet Union and South Africa. Ghana is number three, South Africa is number one, Russia is number two. But Ghana's not producing any gold. Now why not? Because they insist that they can do it themselves. They don't need the British down there. They got rid of them. They got their independence. We don't want the British, they say. We can do it ourselves. The result is no gold is produced. And that's just the way it is. Let me hand this Bible back before I go on to the other scripture. Genesis chapter 22. You turn there, please. Thank you. Genesis chapter 22, verse 15. So we've seen that nations can bless themselves by their attitude towards the Israelites. And again, it makes no difference what those nations are. Verse 15. The angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time and said, By myself have I sworn, says the Eternal. For because you have done this thing, here was the great test for Abraham, where God wanted him to give up his only son, and Abraham obeyed. Abraham was willing to do that. So it is because of Abraham's obedience that God gave the blessing, not because of our righteousness in the 20th century. He said, By myself have I sworn, for because you have done this thing, and have not withheld your son, your only son, in blessing I will bless you. In multiplying, I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven. And one thing we realize in Africa is that the greater your population is, the greater the blessing. One reason why Britain is losing out around the world is because people over here don't have many children now. So there aren't the people to keep on sending out to other countries. And that's one reason why we've got a lot of the problems overseas. In multiplying, I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your seed, now here the word seed is plural. It is talking partly about Jesus Christ, a descendant of Abraham, who brought a great spiritual blessing upon the world, but it is also talking in the plural about Abraham's physical descendants, ordinary people like you and I. In your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. It doesn't say all the nations except Ghana, or all the nations except Nigeria, or except India, or whatever. It says all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in your seed, because you have obeyed my voice. Now, I could go on talking for hours about the blessings that have been brought upon nations, the fulfillment of that prophecy, but you know, we don't have time to look into those things. Now, why is this? Well, we get an indication to a certain extent back in chapter 18. Chapter 18, beginning in verse 17. The Lord said, Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Eternal to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. You see there, one reason God blessed Abraham is because God knew Abraham would pass on to his descendants the truth which he was given. Now, that has not happened to the extent that God would have liked, obviously. If it had done, then everybody in England would be a member of the Worldwide Church of God. But, nevertheless, this book, the Bible, is to a great extent still a major influence in British and American society. What they call the Judeo-Christian ethic, still is the basis of our laws in the Western world, and it is not in other parts of the world. It is still wrong to kill. It is wrong to steal. It is wrong to take another man's wife, although obviously the law today permits that much more. But what I'm trying to show you here is that basically the Western nations, the Israelite nations, still basically have more of God's way in their society than the other nations do. Now, it is becoming less and less so with every year, as we can see in the society around us. But let me just show some things here. The economic system, for example, in the Western world, basically is God's economic system. Not entirely, and don't misunderstand me, but basically it is, in the sense that a person in Britain and America is rewarded to a certain extent if he works harder. The harder you work, the greater the reward, which is not true in Africa. Now, that is God's way. That is God's way. The harder a person works, the greater should be his reward. That is God's way. And still, much more so, that exists in Western society than it does in other nations, but not entirely, as I said. The family system in the West still basically is God's system. A husband, a wife, and their children constitute a family. A husband and wife and their children do not constitute a family in Africa. The family system is one of the major problems and one of the major things that holds the country back. Hygiene. Basically, in the West, our hygiene standards are the same as what God lays down in the Old Testament. Again, not absolutely, not completely, but basically, in the sense that we the Bible commands us to bury our waste, we flush it down the toilet, or we take it to garbage dumps where it's burned. So it's the same principle, more or less. In Africa, that is not the case. People will actually live in the midst of their waste matter, obviously spreading disease and other problems. The political system, even, believe it or not, is closer to God's system in the West than it is in Africa, only insofar as people in Britain and America are not trying to overthrow the established government. Democracy is not God's system, as you know, but one thing that is God's system is that the people should not try to overthrow their governments. And the last time anybody tried to do that in England, I think, was 1642. Nobody's really done it since then, and in America nobody's ever done it or even tried it. So our political system in that sense is closer to God's system. It is those things, and a number of other things which you can think about yourself, it is those things which put the Israelites ahead of other nations. Now, in the future, we see the biblical solution to this major problem in Africa in the book of Micah, chapter 4. Because what is needed before any progress can be made is for a change of attitude towards Israel. Now, it's always interesting listening to Ghanaian politicians in exile, often or usually here in England. They will say, oh, when I get to power, I will welcome the British and the Americans in because I want to see our country really develop and they can help us. Most Ghanaians realize that. The problem is they seem to have a mental block against allowing foreign influence into the country. Because as soon as one of those people becomes president, his attitude changes. And he doesn't want the foreigners in. So nothing is ever changed. And the economy just keeps on getting worse. Micah chapter 4. In the last days, in verse 1, it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord, the government of God, shall be established in the top of the mountains above all other kingdoms, and it shall be exalted above the hills, above the small nations like Ghana and Nigeria and so on, and people shall flow unto it. So there we see that nations, other peoples, other languages are going to flow unto the government of God. And many nations shall come and say, come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the government of God, and to the house of the God of Jacob. You see, today, the peoples of Ghana and other countries do not realize that the God that they profess to worship is the God of Jacob, and that God is blessing the Israelite nations. They think the reason why Britain and America are rich and they are poor is because we exploit them. That's as far as their thinking goes. That's as far as it goes. And yet that is not what the Bible says. Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of God from Jerusalem. So a whole change of attitude. A whole change of attitude in the world tomorrow. I think the book of Zechariah puts it beautifully in chapter 8 and verse 23. Zechariah 8 and verse 23. Because this just shows the attitude of the peoples. Now, when you arrive in a country like Ghana, when you get to the airport, you suddenly have all these children especially, but even some adults, just hanging around you, trying to get something from you, money, or a packet of razor blades, or even a sweet, or a cigarette, or something. They're all coming up and just kind of hanging around you, trying to get something. And this verse reminds me of that. Because in a sense, their attitude is good. They realize that they can get something out of us. Obviously, it's rather selfish. They want to get. But they realize that there is something about us which is different. Verse 23, thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold of all languages of the nations. So all the different peoples of the world, all the different nations, shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, an Israelite, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. Now that'll be much more true in the world tomorrow than it is today. It is true today only in the sense that we've been blessed because of Abraham's obedience. In the world tomorrow it will be even more true when Israel is obeying God. But the other nations, the Gentile peoples of the world, will want to go with the Israelites, because they will see that God is blessing the peoples of Israel. Now, the second major cause of Africa's problems is the misuse of authority. The misuse of authority, the exercise of authority. And Christ himself summed this up beautifully in Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20. And verse 25. If you remember here, two of the disciples were arguing amongst themselves. Well, no, they weren't arguing amongst themselves. The two of the disciples wanted to be sure that they would sit on the right hand and on the left hand of Jesus Christ in the world tomorrow. They wanted to make sure of that. And obviously what they were doing was trying to get a position of authority. And Christ answered them in verse 25 and said, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. Now again, there are much better translations of this verse in other versions of the Bible. I don't think the Revised Standard is any better necessarily, so I won't look at that one. But the New English Bible does say this, and I wrote it down. You know that in the world rulers lord it over their subjects, and their great men make them feel the weight of authority. I think that is a better translation, because it gives the idea of leaders who are haughty and arrogant and despotic. One translation even uses the word despotic. And that sums up most of the leaders of the African nations. Why is it that the Israelites are democracies and the Gentile nations basically are dictatorships? There are one or two exceptions, but basically all Gentile nations are dictatorships. Now why is that? Well, there is a certain misuse of authority. Jesus Christ went on to say here in verse 26, whoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. A minister is simply a servant. Let him be your servant. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. The Passover service, the foot washing, is the great fulfillment of this, when the Master, Jesus Christ, washed the feet of the servants. Something which was entirely new, really. Now, Jesus Christ was talking about the Gentile leaders here. It is the wrong use of authority, which is one of the major problems that you see in Africa. Now, to give you an example, The BBC recently, on the World Service, interviewed a foreign correspondent who had had 25 years of working in dangerous assignments around the world for the BBC. And he was recounting various things that happened to him. And finally, they asked him the question, is there anything that you are still afraid of? And he said, only one thing that I'm still afraid of. And he said, that's an African in a uniform with a gun. And I feel exactly the same way. Because I don't know why it is, but when Africans get into uniform, power goes to their heads. And when they have a gun, it's a thousand times worse. And it is a very, very frightening experience. And it happens every day, because everybody's walking around with guns all the time. Now look at some of the leaders that we have in Africa. Obviously there are better ones than these that I'm going to mention, but I'm just using these as examples. Emperor Bokassa of the Central African Empire used to lead his troops into the local prison and club people to death. And finally he was overthrown by the French, not by his own people, who were terrified of him. He was overthrown by the French because it was proved that he was eating children. And he was a leader. Massias Nguema, who was the president of Equatorial Guinea, killed one third of all the people in his country. Even the Emperor Nero and Claudius, Caligula, worst Roman emperor. Emperors Nero and Caligula could not boast killing a third of the people. But Massias Nguema could. Idi Amin killed at least one out of every seven adults in Ghana, and basically killed all the educated ones, devastating the economy of the country, and got rid of the Indians, who were the backbone of the business community. Sekou Toure of Guinea, he's still in power. One third of all the people in his country have either disappeared or fled the country. President Banda of Malawi, considered respectable over here, power has certainly gone to his head. The front page of the newspaper every day has nothing on it but what the president was doing the previous day. And in Malawi, if you're a visitor and you mention the president in a dining room in a restaurant and somebody overhears you, you'll be given 48 hours to leave the country. The reason is, it is not wrong to talk about the president, but you can't say the president. You must give him his full title, His Excellency the Ungwazi, the Life President, Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda. Now can you imagine if the Queen insisted on us all using her full title? We'd be a republic within 24 hours, because people wouldn't put up with it. Queen Elizabeth II of the United Kingdom and Colonies and Dominions and blah blah blah. People just wouldn't put up with that. But in Malawi you have to. And then President Mobutu of Zaire did a marvelous thing, abolished Christmas, but spoiled it all by replacing it with Mobutu Day. And got rid of most of the established churches, and instead introduced a new religion, Mobutuism. Now he's changed back a little bit now because he's come under American influence. Again, another sign of the advantages of a good relationship with Israel. But all of these things really remind us of what happened in the book of Daniel. If we take a look there just for a few moments, and we see how leaders were back at that time in the book of Daniel. Chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. Now this problem with authority has been a problem that we've had to deal with in the church in Ghana, because whenever people in the past were given positions of responsibility, it doesn't matter what the position was, even if it was just placing the hymn books out, they would throw their weight around. But what can you expect from people when all the examples in their society are bad? Now you can contrast that with some of the examples that we have in England, not all of the examples by any means, and we've got people in England who throw their weight around. But I asked Mr. Stirk to record off British television a documentary on the royal family to show to the church in Ghana, just to give them an idea of a different use of authority. And one of the scenes which was particularly appreciated by the members was when the Queen Mother, during the wedding of Prince Charles and Princess Diana, after the wedding, when she'd been driven back in the carriage to Buckingham Palace, she was noticeably seen thanking the driver for bringing her back to the palace. And that would never, ever happen in Africa. Never. I don't think there's any leader in Africa who would ever thank anybody for anything. Because when you're the boss, when you're the president, you don't thank people, you tell them what to do. If the driver had made a mistake, you get rid of him. If he's done it perfectly, you don't say thank you. Now, obviously, that's bound to influence people in society. So we had a major battle trying to show the people in the church that responsibility and humility and service all go together. And I'm pleased to say that we've succeeded in that respect, and basically today people do understand the right use of authority. But they certainly would not learn it from their own people. Chapter 3 of the book of Daniel, in verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 80 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, and all these other people. And verse 4, a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up." Now this is so common in Africa, that African nations want one religion for all the people, and it is always, effectively, worship of the president. We are trying to get recognition in Cameroon for the church. And I had a policeman come to my hotel room. He wanted to know what I was doing in the country as I was a minister. And he said to me, he said, "We don't want churches in this country. We want people to look to the president." Those were his exact words. So the presidents set themselves up as God. They think they are God. And they want all the people to look to them. And that's exactly the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar was doing. Wanted everybody to look to him, to worship him, or this golden image which he created. "And whoso falls not down and worships shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." The same attitude of intolerance that exists today. If people do not go along with these state religions, then this can be the result. Now, the former British colonies do have more religious freedom than the others do, which again shows the good influence of Israel. Ghana has more religious freedom than the more prosperous French countries around them, because the French themselves really do not have as much religious freedom as Britain has. Therefore, at that time, well, we don't need to really read any further. I think we've learned the lesson from that. Chapter 6, also in verse 4, it's interesting to note in these two passages from Daniel as well that these were hasty decisions made by the leaders of the nations. Hasty decisions. And we suffer from that terribly in Ghana, that the government will decide one day something and they announce it. They rule by decree, and the head of state, Flight Lieutenant Rawlings, will issue a decree which contradicts what he said the previous day, throwing everybody into a state of confusion. And you know, you're just driven crazy by the fact that you have all of these conflicting and confusing laws. "Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion," verse 4, "against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, 'We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God.' Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king, and said thus unto him, 'King Darius, live forever.'" God save the king, in effect. "All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes and so on, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of you, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which alters not." You notice that? The law of the Medes and Persians, which alters not. Now, one of the greatest things about law in Israel is its flexibility. Now, we're not talking here about laws like murder and adultery. We're talking about, say, rules passed by the government. To give you an example, customs and excise, for example, in England. The law says that when you come into the country, they should be searching through your bags and finding out what you bring into the country. But there is a certain flexibility there. If somebody is blind, for example, they probably wouldn't search what they had. If somebody comes off the plane and is sick, they would take them straight off to the hospital. Not in Ghana. You get off the plane, maybe you've just had a heart attack as the plane's landing. You get off the plane, you've still got to have all your bags examined before they take you out. There's no flexibility in the law. The rules say this. The rules say bags have got to be checked. Everybody's bags are checked. Everybody's. And if you just had a heart attack coming off the plane, too bad. There's no flexibility. Now, a few weeks ago, the government controls all prices in Ghana, which is one reason why we don't have anything. But a few weeks ago, the government announced that the price control on beer would be doubled, from 12 cedis, 50 pesos, to 25 cedis, Ghanaian money, which would have meant the breweries finally making a profit. So finally, there might have been beer available. Before that, there wasn't any available, because of the price control being so low. Then the next day, they announced that the import duties would go up by 990%. So, the biggest single ingredient in the beer is malt, which is imported. So now, the breweries were actually worse off. Because what they needed now was to charge about 250 cedis for a bottle of beer instead of 25. Contradictory decrees, which don't make any sense, and there is nothing which anybody can do about it. Nothing at all. Now, the third biggest problem in Africa, the third biggest reason for the problems which Africa has, is the extended family system. We take a look at Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. Now, in England, when you say to somebody, how is your family? You know, if one of you comes up to me and says, how is your family? I'd say, oh, my wife's fine, the children are okay. You go up to an African and say, how's your family? And he would say, well, I haven't been able to get back to my village for a long time, but I think my mother's all right and my uncles are doing okay. Never mentions his wife and kids. That's not the family. The family is the extended family. Now, it's a very confusing system, and it varies from tribe to tribe. But basically, this is the extended family, but it does vary from tribe to tribe. So if you get somebody visiting you here from somewhere in Africa and he says something different to me, please realize that that is the case. Basically, when a woman marries her husband, her allegiance is to her brother. Not to her husband. It is to her brother. And the allegiance of the children is to their uncle, the wife's brother. Or brothers. It is the uncles who are responsible for the upbringing of the children, not the father. Hence, one explanation for why people will have so many children when they are so poor, because they're not their kids. I have a similar problem here with the welfare state, I would think, but not quite to the same extent. But the wife's allegiance basically is to the brother, and the children's to their uncle. And this, even the children are named after their uncles. Now, when my wife and I first arrived in Ghana, really, I don't think we realized that anybody in the church was married to anybody else in the church. Because you would go up to a man and he would say his name was, I'll use English names so you get the picture, but obviously they're not English names. You go to a man and his name was Smith, and then you'd meet a woman and her name was Jones, her last name, and then you'd meet three children, and maybe one of them would be called Rhodes, another one would be called Johnson, another one would be called, trying to think of another name, Eckhart or something. And that you find out 2 years later that they're all one family. Because each child's name is he's named after an uncle. And with 5 or 6 or even 12 children, there's plenty of uncles to name them after, so you never duplicate. The wife keeps the name she had before she got married. The husband's name, of course, is after one of his uncles. So you have absolute chaos and confusion. Tohu and bohu, as the Old Testament would say. And it causes a lot of confusion in Boreham Wood, because I think you know that Youth 83 magazine, for example, if your children are receiving that, or they're receiving the YES lessons, the code which is on their name is the same as the parents' code. And therein is a problem, because here you have a name different, but you're using the same code and the same address, and it blows a fuse in the computer's memory bank, I think. It just can't cope with this incredible family system. But of course the practical problems are that the whole concept of marriage and the family, which most economists would say was the backbone of the development and the wealth of Britain and America in the last century, and even part of this century, is just not there. It's just not there. Why should a man work hard when his nephews reap the benefit? Why work hard for your nephews? Now, you can't say that to an African. He won't see that, because he hasn't felt the blood ties that you and I feel, because we are in a completely different culture. We're in a completely different culture. And our blood ties and our feelings towards our own blood are something which basically is not known in the immediate family in Africa. Now, they will think that they have got the equivalent with their uncles, but they can't have, because that is not God's way. And there is no natural love and affinity for the uncles. What is there is forced by themselves. It is not natural, and therefore it is not as great. A man doesn't have any reason to get on. But notice the problem looking at it from a different angle. My wife and I met a couple, a married couple in Bulawayo in Rhodesia, who were earning far more than we were earning. They had both accomplished themselves a great deal, been to university and so on, and they were earning the equivalent of what then was about $40,000 a year between them. But they were not living very well. Now, they had exercised responsibility and only had 2 children. But unfortunately, all their brothers and sisters had continued to have the 6 to 12 children that everybody else has. And of course, they were responsible for all of them. So there was no way that they could get on. So this family system really causes problems. Now, there is no unemployment, in a sense, in Africa. Everybody has a place, everybody has a job, because of this family system. One of the reasons why there are so many civil servants is because a man is in a position of responsibility in the civil service. All his nephews and nieces will come to him for a job, and that can be 250 nephews and nieces. So you multiply the number of civil servants under British rule by 250 for every, say, 20 years, and that explains why you've got so many civil servants today. That's how people get their jobs. But if a person doesn't have a job at all, then his uncle simply will have to feed him anyway. So it doesn't make any difference if somebody doesn't have any work. Now, Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24 shows us what the family system should be. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. That is the family that God wants. And the reason why God wants that is, well, there are so many reasons. Maybe I'll give a sermon on it sometime. There are so many reasons why God created the family. But it is the backbone of any prosperous society. You take away the family and you're left with collapsing societies, as we see in our own country. I think it's no accident that Britain's divorce rate is high and Britain's economic problems are so great. Britain is in decline, very much so. When Britain was great, its family system was also great. So now we see the country declining because of this. But really, the economic system is a reflection of the family system. People work hard when they've got children. Alistair Cook, a few years ago, presented a history of the United States on British television. Maybe some of you saw it about 10, 12, 15 years ago, maybe. And when he was talking about the Wild West, he said that what was needed in the Wild West was somebody to tame it and develop it. And he said, finally, something came into the West that did that, the family. Once people brought wives and children in, they wanted law and order, they wanted stability, and they wanted to be left alone to develop the region and hand on the prosperity to their children. And the result was that America became the greatest single nation on the face of the earth. It was the family that did it. Wives and children coming in. Now, this extended family system also explains some of the problems that we have all over the world. I'm sure you've all heard of the North-South dialogue, where the poor countries of the world, called the South, are trying to get more money from the rich countries of the world, called the North. Now, when you understand the extended family system, you realize that to an African president, we are all a part of the same family, the human race, and therefore the rich members of the family should give their wealth to the poor members of the family. Never mind that the rich members of the family are working probably 20 or 30 times as hard as the poor members of the family. Never mind that, that's irrelevant. But they want to get what we've got, because that is the extended family system. And no amount of reasoning is going to make them change. Now, the fourth reason, now those are the three major ones, so now we're getting into much smaller reasons for Africa's problems. But the fourth reason is the attitude to private property. Because the communal system in Africa, and in the Soviet Union and everywhere else, certainly holds back economic development. In Ghana, for example, all the time my wife and I lived with the fear that at any time a couple of soldiers could turn up at the door and take everything we had in our house, and there's nothing we could do about it, nothing at all. Now, obviously you might have the same thing to a certain extent here with burglars, and you're not entirely free from worrying about this, but it's not quite the same, because here, if you've got burglars, you've got insurance, you can get the money back, and if somebody steals from you, you can go to the police. My wife and I had our windows stolen. We had these slatted windows. We had those stolen from our house. We called the police in and they took the rest. So you don't have any recourse to any law and order in Africa. Now, everybody lives with the fear that all of their property could be taken away. We were living in a house that we rented from a man called Charles Lai. And after the 1979 coup, when Rawlings came to power the first time, a number of landlords just had their property taken away from them, and for a few days we lived in fear that we were going to be evicted from our house by the government. Now, we had the same thing when Rawlings took over again 18 months ago, because our landlord this time, we've got a different house now, our landlord again came under investigation. He had to go before what is known as the Citizens Vetting Committee, and he had to declare his assets, as they say on the radio. That's the phrase they use, declare his assets. And they were questioning where he got these assets from. Now, if you own anything above, I'll give you examples. If you own anything, really, they consider that you are stealing from other people, that you're exploiting the masses, is the phrase that is used. Now, you are allowed to have in your house six of any particular food item. You can have six tins of beans, which you've obviously brought in from England because you can't buy them in Ghana, six tins of milk, six bars of soap, and so on. If you have more than that, then you are considered to have been exploiting the poor, exploiting the masses, and you can be subject to revolutionary discipline, as they like to term it. I've been threatened with severe revolutionary discipline a number of times by what they call People's Defense Committees, or PDCs, which are styled on the Soviet Union's Soviets, or workers' councils. And these PDCs, supposedly workers' councils, are made up of anybody but workers. They're usually made up of thugs and alcoholics and so on, who are all brought together. And they just go around throwing their weight around. investigating your assets and threatening you with severe revolutionary discipline. And another example, Steve LeBlanc offered to help some of the poorer people in the church to save their second tithe by taking their second tithe from them each month and putting it in a bank account in his name and keeping a record of what they'd given him and giving it back to them at the feast. Now, he did this as a personal favor to help some of the members. And when he went to get that money just before the feast, the sum total was about £100. And they wouldn't let him have the money. They wanted to know, how could you possibly have this much money? Where did you get it from? Have you been exploiting the people? Have you been doing something wrong? And so on. And he told them he was a minister, and he told them what it was for. And it was 45 minutes before they would allow him to have the money, about £100. So we have to be very careful in Ghana to keep the church bank account down to virtually nothing in order to avoid coming under suspicion. In fact, the maximum bank account that an organization can have without being investigated is about £300. Without being investigated. Because above that, you'll be in trouble. This attitude to private property has the result that those people with ability, those people who in spite of all the other problems have managed to get on to a certain extent and accumulate property, what they have to do is get their money out of the country. So the country that prospers from this attitude to private property is Switzerland, with all the wealthy people having bank accounts in Switzerland, where they cannot be touched by the government of Ghana. But the result of this, of course, is that there is no money in Ghana for further investment. There's no money in the banks for the banks to lend out to private individuals to develop the economy. Can you imagine if in Britain, everybody in Britain put their money in a Swiss bank instead of a British bank? All the companies in Britain that rely upon a bank overdraft, whether temporarily or permanently, would never be able to get anything because there'd be nothing in the bank. So here's a poor country like Ghana, desperately in need of investment, but can't have any because of its own policies, which discourage people from saving money. Now Micah chapter 4, again, gives us the solution to that in the future, the biblical solution. Verse 3, talking about, we've already read verses 1 and 2, talking about the world tomorrow. And he shall judge among many nations, many people, and rebuke those nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But notice in verse 4, and I never fully understood this verse till I went to Ghana, but, or, and Rhodesia as well, because in Rhodesia, Europeans had prosperous farms that they had developed and built up over generations, and they were faced with having those farms taken away from them. But in verse 4 it says, they shall sit every man under his vine, personal, private property and possession. God is not a communist. They shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. They will never have to be afraid of soldiers or anybody else coming and taking what they've worked hard for off them, which is the fear that people all over the third world have to live with. That great fear of having it all taken away from them. None shall make them afraid. There won't be any more of that. There won't be any fear of a government nationalizing your business or taking over your land. I mean, that fear even exists in England to a certain extent, that it could happen. And yet God is not going to allow that in the world tomorrow. People must be allowed to reap the physical benefits of their hard labors. Otherwise, they are not going to work hard. And consequently, the whole of society suffers. And that's one thing that African leaders do not understand or appreciate. Hence, one of the reasons for so much poverty. The fifth problem is tribalism. Now, I don't feel that tribalism in Africa is any worse than it is in Europe. What we have to realize is that in Europe, different tribes all have their own countries. The Germans have their own country, the French have their own country, the English have their own country, pretty much. Now, where we see two tribes living together in a European country like Belgium, where you've got the Flemish and the French, we have instability and problems. Even in the United Kingdom, where you've got the Scots-Irish in Northern Ireland and the Danites in Northern Ireland, we have friction, which is basically racial in origin, or tribal. The Scots and the Welsh may not be completely happy with the English. The Bretons in France are not completely happy with the French. And so you see, there is tribalism in Europe. And where you've got in the common market all those different tribes living together, there is nothing but disagreement. You heard the news this morning. So Africa is no worse in this respect. But the problem in Africa is that, and this is a problem that the Europeans caused, but it was not a problem when the Europeans ruled the countries, it is a problem now. The problem is that Africa has artificial borders. In 1884, 99 years ago, at the Treaty of Berlin, the major European nations sat down together, the Germans, the French, the British, the Spanish, the Portuguese and the Belgians, sat down together and they carved up Africa. And they decided on what the borders of their colonies were going to be. And nobody took into account the different tribes. Of course, nobody at that time was ever thinking that those nations would become independent. So naturally, they wouldn't take this into account. But borders basically were based on things like rivers and mountains and so on. But often you have a tribe living on both sides of a river. So you have half a tribe in Ghana and half a tribe in Togo, the country next door. And that, of course, is going to result in many, many problems. Going to result in many problems. And those problems will not be solved until the borders can be redrawn when the kingdom of God is established. The sixth problem is bribery and corruption. And this is probably the thing which most people notice when they first get out to Africa, bribery and corruption, because it exists from the moment you arrive. As I mentioned to you, the import duties have gone up by 990%. So fortunately, my wife and I have left now, but if we were still bringing food into Ghana, the food might cost £100. Now, the food that you would pay £100 for, we would have to pay £250 for, to cover the cost of freighting it out to Ghana. So automatically we're paying roughly 150% more than you. The heavier the item, like sugar or flour, for example, that can even be five times what you're paying. But something light, we'd pay maybe half as much again. So it averages out at about 150% more. When it gets to Ghana, though, under the new import duties, for that £100 of food, your food, £250 we have paid the English company, then we would have to pay £2,500 to the Ghana government. But the customs officials would say, oh, well, you don't have to pay that if you give us maybe 5% of your food. So automatically you're confronted always with bribery and corruption. Now, your choice is simple. Either you give them 5% of your food and you don't pay the duty, I mean, you'll pay a little bit, but they'll bring it down considerably. Or alternatively, you pay the duty and then they steal 10% of your food. Or even 50%. Because they won't like you, you see. And this is how the whole system works. It is a system built entirely on graft and corruption. To an extent, like, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's not a very pleasant film, but it is a good film to see. And if you see it, it gives you an idea of how my wife and I have felt over the last 5 years. In One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, a man who's a criminal in a prison thinks that if he pretends he's insane and get sent to the asylum, it will be easier to escape from the asylum than from the prison. But after living in the asylum for a few months, he ends up going insane. Now, that's how we felt in Ghana, that we've been living in a kind of an asylum, and we felt we were going crazy because we seemed to be the only ones with any sanity. But eventually, of course, all of these things, you end up either having to do them or leave. So you start to feel like you're going crazy. And that's the way it is. But bribery and corruption is a major problem. The church has had two accidents while we've been operating in Ghana. Before I arrived, Mr. Nathan was involved in an accident caused by the lack of spare parts. So that problem does go back a long time, but it's been particularly bad over the last 2 years. Mr. Nathan was driving at night, and there was a truck. As he turned a bend, there was a truck parked on the bend. There's no road rules in Ghana. You know, when you're going around a bend, that's the perfect time to overtake and speed up. So this is why we have so many accidents. But again, you see, to get off the subject, the African attitude to accidents is different to ours. When you're in a taxi and he's driving recklessly, if you say to the driver, "Can you slow down?" he'll laugh at you and say, "You frightened, white man?" And you say, "Look, I don't want my wife and children killed." And he'll say, "If God wants us to die, we'll die, and it doesn't make any difference how I drive." And that's the attitude. So how can you argue with that? It's just a crazy attitude that there's no way you can reason with that argument. So that's why people drive so recklessly and we have so many people killed. But Mr. Nathan on this particular night was just going round the bend, and there suddenly in front of him was a truck. It was dark. The tailgate was down, covering the lights. As it turned out, there were no lights anyway, no reflective lights anyway, because of the spare part problem. And he just ran right into the thing. The car was a complete write-off. Now, we could have taken that man to court, but the end result would be that whoever paid the judge the most money, the judge would rule in that person's favour. So we now insure our vehicles in England to avoid that problem, so we still get paid out to replace the vehicle, regardless of whatever happens in the court case. There's no point in going to court. Last year, Mr. LeBlanc had an accident in the Land Rover. I was with him. My son was with him, too. Very bad accident we had. The Land Rover was a write-off. And it was caused by a bus driver who was drunk. And he was actually dancing in the aisle. He was driving the bus, you know, holding the wheel with that hand, and standing up next to it and dancing while he was driving. Perfectly acceptable. It happens all the time. I've been on buses where the driver's done that. I just try to read the book and close my eyes and pray and just hope that I get there. But that's what he was doing, and then he had an accident and hit us. Could we take him to court? Yes, we could, but again, why bother? Because the end result, in fact, we did start a court process, but I turned up at court the first time, and you know, I'd received a letter telling me the court case was on a certain day at a certain time. We got there to find that it was going to be the next week. It's 100 kilometers each way. That's 200 kilometers. With petrol rationing, it means you're using a lot of your petrol. We went back again the second time to find, again, the judge wasn't there, and we had to come back the following week. I think the next time, the court, they'd already met in the court, and the judge had ruled in the other person's favor. So what can you do, you see? It's a question of whoever pays the judge the most money. Something you're never going to get around. Well, when Rhodesia got its independence to Zimbabwe, we heard from some church members there who said that within 2 weeks of independence, within 2 weeks of changing from the British rule, because Ian Smith really was British, to African rule, the police wanted bribes. Within 2 weeks, that's how quick it changes. It's incredible. And that's how it is all over, you see. And there's nothing you can do about those things, of course, until the kingdom of God is established. But when you have a system like that, and when nobody can trust anybody, and everybody's trying to get, I know in our society everybody's trying to get to a certain extent, but not to anywhere near this extent. When you have a system like that, it's hopeless trying to have any economic prosperity. One reason why there is so much prosperity in the West is because there is a certain amount of trust. Checks, credit cards, bank accounts, all of those things are built on trust. In Ghana, you can't use a check. We have a bank account purely because Pasadena does a worldwide audit, and there's a worldwide kind of banking system for the church, and everything has to go through the bank. But quite frankly, the best thing for Ghana would be to have no bank account at all. No point. You pay money into the bank and you can't get it out. You can get it out, you know, by issuing checks, but most people won't take checks. So, you know, you have a difficulty using the money that's in the bank account. We do use it. We don't waste any of it. But it's very difficult to actually use it. People will not accept checks because nobody trusts anybody else. Now, when I was in Rhodesia, when I first got out there, a lot of the people I worked with, Africans, could not have bank accounts because, basically they were not trustworthy. Now, they would say, it's not fair that you white people can go into banks and you write out a check and you get money from the bank. Why can't we do that? And you would try to explain to them that, first of all, you've got to put money in the bank before you can take it out. But people had no realization of that. The average person had no realization of that. Obviously, the elite did. You know, the top 1 or 2% in the country did. But the ordinary man on the street really thought that Europeans simply went into banks and just got money on demand, so to speak. You see, well, the problem that you've got in Africa really is that people 100 years ago, when the British and the French arrived in Africa, the people were living in the Stone Age. And people like to think that in 100 years they've been developed from the Stone Age to the 20th century, which just isn't true. And it is not true of us either. If you think back in our history, the Romans came to England in 54 BC. And you read what the Romans said about the English and how primitive our ancestors were. The Romans developed the British economy. You can still see some of that development, even in the West Country and various parts in Bath and so on. But the Romans left 500 years later in 476 AD, and what happened when the Romans left? A total collapse, pretty much. Not total, maybe, but a great collapse. We entered the Dark Ages. And then England started to come up again 600 years later, when again it was invaded by foreigners, the Norman Conquest. But that period between Roman rule and the Norman Conquest is the Dark Ages, when basically we were a very primitive peoples. 500 years of Roman rule, and we went back more or less to what we were. How can we expect the Africans, who were more primitive to start with, to cope with the 20th century after only about 70 or 75 years of British and French rule? It's just not possible. They're not able to cope with the 20th century. Most people are still living out in the bush in the way that their ancestors have lived for thousands of years. And the only thing that is going to change them is 1,000 years of rule by the government of God. 1,000 years of the government of God. Before I went to Africa, I used to think, why does it have to be 1,000 years? 2 or 3 generations and, you know, God could have everything sewed up nicely. Now that I've been in Africa, I wonder if it's long enough. Because the problems are just so great. It's going to take that long to undo some of these customs and things which hold the people back. It's going to take 1,000 years to put things right. Now, the seventh thing which holds the people back is the perverted religious practices. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Now, this is not number 7 in order of importance, I'm sure you appreciate. I mention it last because, in a sense, it sums up everything, in a sense. The first problem I gave you, I think, is the biggest single problem. The second would be the second biggest, the third. But the other four are not really necessarily in any order, and the number 7 really does sum up everything. The perverted religious practices. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, God gave the Israelites a command regarding the peoples of Palestine. Now, everything I've talked about today, I've talked about at great length in the churches in Ghana. And the peoples in Ghana have a great understanding now of how to put things right. God is calling those people for a number of reasons. Now, we don't know exactly what those reasons are. Sometimes I've said to Mr. Nathan, in fact, I mentioned this once to Mr. Armstrong, that the French countries around Ghana are so prosperous, why has God not called Africans from those countries into the church? It would be so pleasant for my wife and I to live there, because we could sit under palm trees and get suntans and drink all the drinks, you know, from England and so on, and eat the nice food. But there's none of that in the English-speaking countries. You can't even get a Coca-Cola in Ghana. No beer, no water a lot of the time. No tea, none of these drinks. I mean, a lot of them I know are bad for you, but you can't even get the good drinks in those countries. So there is just nothing to compensate, in a sense, for all the deprivation. In the French countries, you've got all the compensations. And my wife and I would sometimes go to these countries and visit them and think, why, oh why, doesn't God call people from these countries? Why from Ghana? Why from Nigeria? Which must be the two worst places on the face of the earth. And I think one of the answers to that is because in the world tomorrow, the government of God is going to be ruling over Africa, and the people that God has called out of these African countries are going to be a great example to the other peoples that God will call in the world tomorrow. The peoples in the French countries have had it so easy. They've had it so easy. They're really living in Europe, in a sense. All of the French countries look like a run-down Marseille. A poorer Marseille. That's all they look like. They look very French. The French language, the French culture dominates. So those people really are living in a kind of a France. They're living in a semi-Israel already. But in the world tomorrow, people are going to have to look for examples, to look at people who have already overcome Africa and have qualified to rule in God's kingdom. And our people in the church are overcoming Africa. They're breaking away from their family systems. They're learning some of the things that I've been talking about today. They're learning how to use authority in the right way. They've changed their attitude towards the Israelites. They're getting away from the tribalistic problems. Changing their attitude to all of these things that we're talking about. And they're a fine example for all of the people that God is going to call in the world tomorrow. But 3,000 years ago, and I mentioned this to the church in Ghana, in fact in the Spokesman's Club I gave the people an assignment, the graduate club actually, not the Spokesman's Club, I gave the men an assignment to study into the Canaanites in the Old Testament, the ancestors of the Africans, and find a custom of the Canaanites in the Old Testament and show where that custom is still practiced today in Africa. And they did that, and they did a beautiful job on that, coming up with some obscure customs that are mentioned basically in the first seven books of the Old Testament. God in chapter 7 of Deuteronomy says something which is very strong about the peoples of Palestine, and that includes the ancestors of today's Africans. When the Lord your God shall bring you, the Israelites, into the land where you go to possess it, and have cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, stronger physically. And when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, you shall smite them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant, no peace treaty with them, nor show mercy unto them. Now why was God so strong in all of that? Well, let's read on. I mean, this really is genocide that God was telling Israel to commit. Neither shall you make marriages with them. Your daughter you shall not give unto his son, nor his daughter shall you take unto your son. For they will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their images, and cut down their groves, and burn their graven images with fire. For you are a holy people unto the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. So reading that, we see the basic problem was the religious practices of the peoples, of the non-Israelite peoples. That is why God wanted those people destroyed by the Israelites. Because their religion was so perverted, and because their religion would corrupt the Israelites. That was the problem. And that happens every day. People from Britain and America go out to places like Ghana, and especially to countries in the East, and they end up coming back as Buddhists and Hindus and so on. And this is what God is referring to here. But when you look at some of the customs of the animist customs, the local religion is known as animism, when you look at the customs of the people, the religious customs, you can understand why God said this. The Tifa Dalary is a local elder. He's employed, he's the manager of the office in Nigeria. He's a Nigerian. He was brought up as a Muslim. His wife is from Jamaica. A couple of years ago, they were away for a few days and they left their children at their house with another local elder and his wife. Now this man was away, and a woman came to the house claiming to be Latif's aunt. And she said, our mother, the children's grandmother, is very sick and she wants to see the children immediately. Well, only two of Latif's children were there. But Mrs. Chukwudi, the other minister's wife, said, okay, well, the children can go with you. And then the woman said, well, I need some money as well for the taxi. So Mrs. Chukwudi gave her some money and took the children off. Now, a few minutes later, fortunately, Mr. Chukwudi came back. And when he heard this, he immediately realized nobody knew who this woman was. And it's quite possible she was not a relative. So he ran to the bus stop. And he got there just as she was getting into a taxi with the two children. And he pulled her out and started threatening her and told her, we've got no proof that you're their aunt. Give us proof. And she had no proof, of course. And he insisted on getting the money back as well. Now, it turned out she was not a relative. Why was she taking the children? Mr. Jackson has often said that he believed firmly that in the house next door they were sacrificing children. Now, I slept one night in the Adalari's house, and I remember a child just screaming, this great kind of blood-curdling scream, for about an hour or so in the next door while I was there. Now, Mr. Jackson really felt that that was what was going on, because it happened all the time, and that could have happened to the Adalari's two children. Now, those are the sort of things that you have. And then the members come and tell you other things. You know, if twins are born, for example, the youngest twin is put to death because it's considered unlucky. Now, there are so many things involved in the pagan animist religions, and you can see why God told the Israelites to do this, because they are such sickening things. And those things are only going to be put right in the kingdom of God. Brethren, one thing we have to realize is that the further Africa gets away from Israelite rule, and Ghana now has been independent for 26 years, the further it gets away from it, the more the people are going back to the customs that they had before the Israelites went to Africa. So the greater the pressures on the church members to conform to the local customs. And brethren, if the kingdom of God is not established soon on this earth, then the Church of God in Africa will be lost. It will be impossible for our members to continue in the worldwide Church of God. Now, some of them will not give in, they will not compromise, but as we saw with Nebuchadnezzar, eventually the end result would be that they'd be put to death anyway by other people. I was telling Mr. Bedford on Thursday that I have stopped visiting people in Ghana in the rural areas. One reason is the petrol rationing. But the main reason is that people living in rural areas find it almost impossible to fight against all of these customs. And what I do when somebody in a rural area asks for a visit, I send them a letter inviting them to come and see me in Accra. Because if they do that, they have made the first step away from the family and the tribe and all of the customs that go with it. If they're not willing to make that first step to come and see me in Accra, then they will never break away from their family system. So I'd just be wasting my time to visit them anyway. And the church members really are spiritually very strong, but the problems just get worse almost by the month. Really, it's a rapid decline that the country's in. And the more it declines, the more the people return to the customs they had hundreds and thousands of years ago. So the greater the pressures on the church members. And if the kingdom of God is not established soon, then the church of God will just cease to exist in Africa.